Chapter 3. Shortly before midnight, the impostor began his practiced drill to abandon the jetliner. The air was sparkling clear, and the dim smudge that was Iceland rose above the flat, black horizon line of the sea. The small island country was outlined by a faint but eerie display of greenish rays from the aurora borealis. He was oblivious to the dead men around him. He had grown used to the smell of blood, and it no longer sickened him. Death and gore simply went with the job. He was as indifferent to mutilated bodies as a pathologist or the neighborhood butcher. The impostor was quite clinical about killing. Numbers of dead were merely mathematical sums. He was paid well. He was a mercenary, as well as a religious fanatic who murdered for a cause. Oddly, the only part of his work that offended him was being called an assassin or a terrorist. He detested the words. They had a political ring about them, and he nurtured a passionate dislike for politicians. He was a man of 1,000 identities, a perfectionist who rejected random gunfire in crowds or sloppy car bombs, considering them tools for juvenile idiots. His methods were far more subtle. He never left anything to chance. International investigators found it difficult to separate many of his hits from what appeared to be accidents. The death of Hala Kamil was more than an assigned task. He considered it a duty. His elaborate plan had taken 5 months to perfect, followed by the patient wait for the opportune moment. Almost a waste, he mused. Kamil was a beautiful woman, but she was a threat that had to be nullified. He gently eased back on the throttles and nudged the control column forward, beginning a shallow rate of descent. To anyone but another pilot, the slight drop in speed and altitude was imperceptible. The main cabin crew had not troubled him. By now the passengers were dozing, attempting but failing to fall into the deep sleep so elusive on long aircraft flights. For the 20th time he rechecked his heading and studied the dwindling numbers on the panel computer, which he had reprogrammed to indicate the time and distance to his drop zone. 15 minutes later, the jetliner crossed over an uninhabited section of Iceland's southern coastline and headed inland. The landscape below became a montage of gray rock and white snow. He lowered the flaps and reduced speed until the Boeing 720B was flying at 352 kilometers an hour. He re-engaged the autopilot on a new radio frequency transmitted from a beacon placed on the Hofsjökull, a glacier rising 1,737 meters from the center of the island. Then he set the altitude so the aircraft would impact 150 meters below the peak. Methodically, he smashed and disabled the communication and direction indicators. He also began dumping fuel as a backup in case a flaw somehow marred his carefully conceived plan. 8 minutes to go. He dropped through the trapdoor into the hellhole. He already wore a pair of French para-boots with thick elastic soles. He hurriedly removed a jumpsuit from the duffel bag and slipped into it. There had been no room for a helmet, so he pulled on a ski mask and stocking cap. Next came a pair of gloves, goggles, and an altimeter, which he strapped to one wrist. He clipped the harness snaps and checked the straps for snugness. He wore a piggyback rig where the reserve sat on his shoulder blades and the main chute fit into the small of his back. He relied on a ram air canopy, a square airfoil that is more flown than jumped. He glanced at the dial of his watch. 1:20. He opened the escape door and a rush of air swept through the hellhole. He studied the sweep second hand on the watch and began counting down. When he reached zero, he launched his body through the narrow opening feet first, facing in the direction of flight. The velocity of the airstream struck him with the icy force of an avalanche, crushing the breath from his lungs. The plane soared past with a deafening roar. For a brief instant he felt the heat from the turbine's exhaust, and then he was away and falling. Face down in a stable, arched and spread position, knees slightly flexed, hands spread in front, Lemke looked down and saw only blackness. No lights burned on the ground. He assumed the worst. His crew had failed to reach the correct rendezvous point. Without a defined target zone, he could not gauge his wind drift or direction. He might land kilometers away, or worse, impact in the middle of jagged ice with serious injury and never be found in time. In 10 seconds, he had already dropped nearly 360 meters. The needle on the luminous dial of his altimeter was crossing into the red. He could not wait any longer. He pulled the pilot chute from a pouch and threw it into the wind. It anchored to the sky and strung out the main canopy. He heard the chute open with a satisfying thump, and he was jerked into an upright position. He took his penlight and aimed the narrow beam over his head. The canopy blossomed above him. Suddenly, a small circle of lights blinked on about 1 mile away to his right. Then a flare went up and hung for several seconds, just long enough for him to judge wind direction and speed. He pulled on the right steering toggle and began gliding toward the lights. Another flare went up. The wind held steady with no fluctuation as he neared the ground. He could clearly see his crew now. They had laid out another line of lights leading to the previously lit circle. He jockeyed the steering goggles and made a 180-degree bank into the wind. Lemke prepared to strike the ground. His crew had chosen the terrain well. The balls of his feet made contact with soft tundra, and he made a perfect stand-up landing in the center of the circle. Without a word, he unsnapped the harness and walked outside the glare of the lights. He looked up at the sky. The aircraft, with its unsuspecting crew and passengers, flew straight toward the glacier that gradually rose, closing the gap between ice and metal. He stood there watching as the faint sound of the jet engines died and the blinking navigation lights melted into the black night.